The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. Listen on demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Now available free for both iPhone and Android devices.
And so now on to our next discussion of the day. On the Ring Central Hotline, we have Carl Weinberg, High Frequency Economics. Carl, first of all, welcome.
Thanks for having me on your new show.
New time. I like to say, same great show, same great guests, just a new time. And of course, you are one of our stalwart, faithful guys, always joining us to talk about Europe and the global economy. I just can't resist, though, since Courtney brought up ding-dongs and all that. Did you eat that stuff when you were a kid?
I cannot deny that statement.
Which was your favorite?
I'm always a Hostess Cupcakes guy.
Okay. Did you eat the little cream filling out first and then eat the chocolate last?
I did not.
Okay. You had it all together.
All right. Okay, so now let's move on to, I want to start with Japan, I think, because I know you're dying to talk about what's really happening in Japan. And Japan now, you know, the Nikkei rallying so sharply since April 4th when the Bank of Japan announced this, you know, double their bond purchases by the end of 2014. You have been a yen bear for some time. You remain a yen bear. Talk to us about your latest analysis, Carl.
Well, you know, this thing in Japan is much more complicated than meets the eye. The headline says 60 trillion yen worth of bond purchases, roughly $600 billion worth, and the market's gone nuts, and everybody figures this money's going to end up in the stock market, and boom-bada-boom-bada, the Nikkei jumps. But at the end of the day, the Bank of Japan was already buying about $220 billion a year worth of bonds anyhow, and only about 10 billion of the total increase in their balance sheet that they're going to implement is going to be in things other than bonds, mostly lending. So that really leaves about 28 billion, or about half as much as everybody's thinking about going into the monetary system. The money that's going to be printed is going to go to banks, and that means that for the money to get into the economy, banks have to lend it out, and they ain't doing that. This is not going to be a case like would happen when the Fed buys funds from the market, where money comes out of the pockets of, where bonds come out of the portfolios of individual investors and are then immediately deployable into things like stocks. A lot of this money is going to be invested in overseas bonds. So I'm not sure that this rally in the stock market, which is betting that all this cash is going to end up in stocks, I just don't see it happening.
Carl, why won't the banks lend it out? What's stopping them?
Well, for one thing, their balance sheets have been impaired since 1990. And, you know, since we had the great crash in stocks back in 1990, banks which had loaned a lot of money collateralized on stocks have had balance sheet problems, sort of like what Europe's getting itself into right now by not fixing its banks properly. Also, you know, Japan is a contracting economy. I mean, we have a declining labor force, and that means we have should expect to see declining GDP, all aspects of the economy declining. There aren't a lot of investment opportunities in an economy that's contracting, not nearly as many as in an economy that's expanding. So you take an extra 28 trillion yen, which is about 5% of GDP, and even if all the money were available for investment, you'd be hard-pressed to find investment projects. By the way, if you look at investment spending in Japan over the last dozen years, it's been coming down absolutely over the last dozen years, reflecting the decline in the population and the decline in demand and therefore the need for less productive capacity.
And so much focus, as you pointed out in one of your recent notes, on monetary policy, rightfully, right? I mean, this is a dramatic move by the Bank of Japan, and the Fed's doing it, and Europe has their aggressive monetary stance as well. Not so much focus on these kinds of things, like a changing labor force and what that means, right?
Right. Well, in the U.S., of course, we have an expanding labor force. We have not only natural growth of our population. I mean, our baby boomers are retiring, but we have a decent number of young people coming into the workforce. But more importantly, Kathleen, we have immigrants who are coming into the United States. People still want to come here, and they're still looking for work. And while some people view that as being a negative thing, at the end of the day, we're a nation of immigrants, and the people who come into this country are tomorrow's taxpayers and tomorrow's consumers, and they're the ones who compel a pushing outward of the production possibility frontier. That's what drives investment, and that's what makes the economy grow. Europe also has a demographic challenge, not quite as severe as Japan's, but they are contracting too, and they are not getting an immigration bulge either by design. So the demographics are something, you know, we used to never think about it. We just used to take it for granted that the population was going to grow by 1% per year, and that that was going to give us a constant drive to demand and therefore a constant reason for our economies to grow. It's not the case in Japan.
So Japan is migrating to a smaller economy by necessity then, Carl. I mean, is that necessarily a bad thing? Are there ever examples of an economy that contracts and still manages to progress, if you like?
Well, you know, Vani, we don't have a lot of examples of that in modern times, but if you think through what it means, you know, in Japan, we still have, you know, science and technology making workers more productive. We have a smaller number of workers, for sure, but we have less demand for output. So what we end up with is that productivity gains, instead of being used to produce more stuff, which is what happens in a growing economy, instead gets used to lower the cost of making the amount of stuff that we already have. Unit labor costs fall. And what this means for Japan is that Japan's economy is doomed for deflation, regardless of monetary policy, and that I expect the Bank of Japan's measures won't succeed in their stated goal of getting inflation up to 2%, because with output falling and the workforce falling, any surge in demand that's created by printing money is just going to pop out the door in the form of imports. It's going to be cheaper and easier to get to buy the stuff from abroad than to try to make more of it with a shrinking workforce.
That's chilling.
It's quite chilling, and we're going to continue our conversation with Carl Weinberg, chief economist and founder of High Frequency Economics. Wanted to ask him a little bit more about Japan and Asia, because the move towards aggressive monetary easing, some say, is maybe another step in the currency war, but more within Asia rather than against the U.S. and Europe. And of course, we do want to ask him about Europe, Slovenia, and more. All coming up next. Hayes Advantage, Bloomberg Radio. 15 minutes from now. Let's get back to our guest on the Ring Central Hotline, Carl Weinberg. He is CEO and founder of, and chief economist, I should say, of High Frequency Economics. I want to spend a little more time on Japan, Carl, because we have a story on the Bloomberg terminal today looking at, I just got to get you the headline here because I love it. Yen losses seen in canned tuna prices eroding yields. And it's talking about rising prices on everything from canned tuna to ramen noodles showing early signs of inflation. But in your piece today, you basically go through all the things the Bank of Japan can do, four major steps you look at, and you say basically nothing's going to create inflation.
Well, Kathleen, the decline in the yen value of the yen makes the prices of some things in Japan more expensive. And if Japan imported everything from abroad, then the price of everything in the consumer basket would go up. But that still wouldn't be inflation, because inflation would require an increase in wages, which are falling in both real and nominal terms. But in fact, Japan imports a relatively small proportion of its consumer bundle. And while some things like oil, for example, are priced in U.S. dollars and go up, and those are important prices, what we're seeing are relative price changes of imported goods compared to other goods, rather than an overall rise in all prices and wages, which is inflation. So it's a difference between a microeconomic shock and a macroeconomic shock. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. All right, in the U.S., when gas prices went up recently, any of the recent times that gas prices have gone up, it seems like they're always going up. But we don't really have very much inflation in the United States. What happens when gas prices go up is that people have to spend more money on gasoline, and that leaves less money over to spend on other stuff, and therefore consumption of goods that are other than gasoline goes down because they're more expensive, and our incomes haven't risen to compensate for the gas price change. So you don't have to get inflation just because imported goods prices are going up. It's a much more complicated mechanism. And we will see the CPI perhaps go up a little higher, and that may affect inflation expectations. But I don't believe we're going to get enough of a push out of this to get to 2% inflation.
Carl, you mentioned that with the Bank of Japan moves that, you know, imports will go up, obviously, and that that's what will happen as opposed to anything in the domestic economy. But, you know, we also get a much, much weaker yen. Won't that put a cap on imports at least and make, you know, exports a bit more attractive?
Oh, Bonnie, so many people think that the only thing that matters to imports is the price. And every economics course teaches us that you have both a price effect or a substitution effect out of goods and into goods as prices changes, but you also have an income effect. So if imports are becoming more expensive, right, but you have more income to spend on imported goods, then you're just as likely to get an increase in imports as you're likely to get a decrease. So the depreciation of the yen is an important part of the story, and it'll tend to taper off to slice off some of the growth of imports. But that income effect is probably going to be the more important thing. If the Bank of Japan pumps money into the economy, and that does manage to stimulate more demand, and that demand has no place to go, they're not producing more stuff in Japan, then it'll become cheaper to import stuff from abroad at any exchange rate than to try to make more stuff at home with fewer workers.
So you have been pretty bearish long-term on the yen. Do you remain so? Does this latest move alter that at all?
No, I remain extremely bearish on Japan's economy, both in the short term and in the long term. I view the driving force in the immediate near term. Let's distinguish between the near term outlook and the medium term outlook. The driving force is a decreasing population, of course, also declining export potential for Japan at any exchange rate, because Asian competitors are stealing business away from Japan, and their labor is much more competitive than Japanese labor is at any possible exchange rate of the yen. So Japan will continue to lose export share to other producers in Asia, and we also have the government sector squeezing out, crowding out more and more private sector demand and consumption by having to service the debt on, by having to service the interest on its huge public sector debt.
Well, Carl, is this a flat-out illustration of monetary policy failing? And what do economists need to do about that?
Well, I think that monetary policy in this case is the wrong policy. You know, I think that a careful look at why prices are going down in Japan takes me, at least, and I think several other economists, into the realm of looking at the nexus of technology advances at a time when workforce is decreasing, and how do those productivity gains get used. And I think that monetary policy can't possibly address that. It's a mistake, and it's not going to work. Is it a textbook example? Well, to my mind, every example is different. So I don't think this fits into, I don't think Japan's situation in any way fits into a certain box or compartment and says, well, this is this kind of a problem. Japan is facing a unique set of circumstances right now that, frankly, we haven't seen very often.
Carl, and so does this mean that perhaps the supporters of quantitative easing in the United States, looking at the work of Woodford and others on expectations, are on the right track, but that somehow the Japanese model is so different, this whole expectations kind of model, what it means for investors, ultimately consumers and businesses, doesn't work? Or is everybody off base?
Well, you know, Kathleen, I'm not an expert on the U.S. economy, but I do look around me as I live here, and for goodness sake, we've now had hugely expansionary monetary policy since 2008, and I don't see inflation raising its ugly head anywhere in the United States. And we've had huge monetary expansion in Britain, and while Britain has higher inflation than they'd like, at 3%, it's not, prices really aren't jumping off the map either.
Okay, well, we're going to continue with Carl Weinberg from High Frequency Economics here on the Hayes Advantage Bloomberg Radio. Bearish on Japan, bearish on the yen. What does he see for Europe? Slovenia's on the hot seat. What's next?
This portion of the Hayes Advantage is brought to you by The Book of Mormon. The best musical of the century, raves the New York Times, now playing at the Eugene O'Neill Theatre on Broadway, The Book of Mormon. For ticket information, visit telecharge.com.
Back at the top of the hour with more. Let's get back to Carl Weinberg now, joining us from High Frequency Economics. We've been talking a lot about Japan, but of course that's not surprising. Just days ago, the Bank of Japan announced a bold new step into more aggressive monetary policy to get its economy going. I heard from Carl that no, it's not going to happen. They're on the wrong track, and he's very bearish on the yen. But let's go to Europe, because Carl, as you know, there's still a lot going on there. We've had some numbers from Germany the last couple of days. We started the week with a rally, say, in Spanish bonds. Boy, the key yield back below 2%. where should we start? Do you want to start with the core countries, Germany, the economy? Do you want to jump over to Slovenia, which looks like it's the next one on the docket for a bailout?
Well, let's start with the big picture and then drill down to Slovenia next. You know, Germany's industrial production this morning surprised everybody to the upside. That's great. But 1 month doesn't make a trend. You know, Germany's industrial production on trend is headed down. And to be honest with you, you know, we can't rule out the fact that something wacky happened in the seasonal adjustment of these numbers, because they're seasonally and workday adjusted, and it's a February, and last February was a leap year, and maybe they were just a little bit too aggressive in accounting for that. So, you know, the German numbers overall, you look at the big picture of industrial production, we have one of them in our weekly report this week, going back for many years, and the trend in industrial production is down over the last 2 years, and it's down over the last 5 years, and it continues to get worse. What's wrong in Europe is that banks are undercapitalized, they're reducing the amount of lending they're doing to improve their capital bases, and that reduction of credit is squeezing the economy to death. So who suffers the most in this scenario? Small countries, all right? Countries that have fiscal problems of their own, maybe have some big banks domiciled there for a variety of reasons, and that's how Cyprus got into trouble. To be honest, that's how Ireland got into trouble. To be honest, that's the core and the problem behind Spain, which still has substantial banking problems despite its very, very nice presence in the market. And, of course, we have Slovenia today, which is almost certain to be the next country to fall under the gun and to require some kind of a banking sector restructuring. So this is an ongoing thing, and we're in a little bit of remission on the story for Spain and on the story for Italy, which still doesn't have a government, but these things are going to come back and bite us. You can be sure of it.
Does Europe need a strong Germany, Carl?
Well, right now, in terms of an economy, Germany is the best part of Europe. It's the strongest organ, if you will, in a complex mechanism. Whatever Germany is doing to contribute to growth, to contribute to economic stability, to still have a fairly stable banking system in the zone where there's a lot of trouble within the banking system, well, that's, you know, it's good. Whatever they're doing is good. Of course, their idea of how to fix it may not always be the most expeditious one, and that's a problem. So we're a little bit skeptical about their approach to their prescriptions for other countries. But sure, any jobs that Germany can create, any demand that Germany can create is welcome in a time when most of its partners are being squeezed to death by a credit crunch.
Is it your view that the Eurozone will stay together in as it is now without any departures?
Oh, you always ask me that question, Kathleen. And
well, because I don't think the answer is in yet. That's why I keep asking, right? I mean, whatever people say, yes or no, the time has passed. You've got, you know, Greece suffering. You've got questions over Portugal. I mean, am I asking the wrong question? Is it time to stop asking that question because the answer is so clear?
I think the more fruitful question is how and what form will Europe move forward? Because I don't think EMU is going to fall apart. All right, nobody gets paid for leaving EMU. You know, Germany's business is selling its stuff to its European partners, and it sells more of it to Europe when it stays within EMU than if it leaves or if anybody else leaves. You know, you look at the pictures on Bloomberg television of the riots in Greece, and you see the presenter in the front, you see the rioters in the back. You don't care about them. You want to look at the parking lot, which is filled up with BMWs and Mercedes and Audis and Volkswagens. And that's the story of Europe. Germany makes, Europe takes. And the Greeks, for example, or any of the southern tier countries, would be worse off for not having all these great goods that Germany makes at an affordable price, and the Germans would be worse off for not making them. So nobody gets paid for breaking up Europe. I don't think it's going to happen. But there has to be a change in order to make it more viable, because the current institutional setting, as ECB President Draghi calls it, is unsustainable. It's impractical. There are constitutional restraints on the relationships that governments can have with each other. There are constitutional restraints on the ECB. So there are constitutional restrictions that prevent uniform banking supervision and mutually financed credit deposit schemes. So as a result, we have no choice but to fold banks, for instance, for lack of a better mechanism to fix them. So we have to see constitutional changes and institutional changes, and that'll take years. And in the meantime, Europe's going to have a depression, and there's not really much that policy can do to avert that.
Well, national courts and constitutional courts, as you say, Carl, have been playing a role in this crisis from the beginning, whether it was Germany or now Portugal. You know, how many more of these court procedures are we going to see? And I mean, it's coming up the works. Is it going to stop this process from happening?
Well, you know, in the United States, we had this before we had our Constitution. All right, we had a different set of circumstances under which states were bound together loosely without fiscal links, because the states wanted to maintain their fiscal integrity, without jurisdictional links because they wanted to maintain their sovereignty, and without a common banking system. And it took the United States 15, 20 years to come around to defining our own constitution back in the 18th century, and it took another 100 years beyond that before we got central banking down right. So I would say that we have a lot of these challenges as the states in Europe resist giving up sovereign rights that they've been used to enjoying, but that they have to sacrifice in order to be part of a common union. So, Vani, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It's going to be a while before all of this works itself out. It's going to be a hard battle to get the changes to the Constitution and the laws that are needed. And in the meantime, it's not going to work very well. It's going to be relatively inefficient compared to what it could be, although more efficient than the countries would function without it.
I want to hop back to Asia for a minute. Bank of Japan's aggressive monetary policy weakened their currency. How is that going to play out vis-a-vis other countries, China, for example?
Well, right now, China's yuan has pretty much stabilized against the U.S. dollar. So the Chinese seem to be content with what's happening on their overall trade picture. Their trade numbers have been surprisingly strong, and they're happy to let their currency appreciate against the yen with the U.S. dollar. So in terms of, you know, China's situation, I think they have really good growth prospects moving forward at pretty much any exchange rate. Remember, most of their growth is domestic. In my view, the big constraint on growth has been that food prices took off last year and the year before and squeezed out spending of other goods and services in the same way that we were talking about a few minutes ago when we were talking about exchange rates. And right now we saw the CPI figure that came out last night showed that food prices slowed at a startling rate down to 2.5% from 6% in February, and of course from 14.8% in the summer of 2011. So this slowing of food prices, I think, guarantees that regardless of the exchange rate, we're going to see a surge of domestic demand in China, unleashed by having to spend less money on food and therefore having more money to spend on other stuff. And I think by the second quarter of this year, China's going to be back.
You know, on China, Carl, what we do here in the U.S. in terms of interest rates greatly affects them. Why is there so much fear of more tightening in China?
Well, I don't rightly know. I'm not really afraid of what you mean fear of U.S. tightening in China.
Well, every time there's, you know, an effort to rein in the housing market or whatever in China, you know, stocks sell off. And I say fear as in risk off.
Well, you know, the housing market in China is really talked about.
Okay.
And everybody, you know, knows somebody who's been to some kind of a failed housing project. We all saw the television news program about how housing is in, you know, great disarray there. But with 1.3 billion people in China, this doesn't really affect most of them, you know, just as the housing crisis in Detroit doesn't really affect us in New York or the U.S. outlook.
Carl Weinberg, thanks for joining us.
You can listen to The Hayes Advantage weekdays at 12:30 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.